Thanks for listening to Air Talk. While Larry Mantle is away, I'm Libby Denkman, sitting in a very big chair that I'm filling here for Larry, trying to do my best to hold the show down while he is taking a much-needed vacation. Coming up in a few minutes, we're going to talk about independent voters in this state and whether they should be able to use the Democratic or Republican presidential ballots for the March 3rd primary, even if they don't specially request one, at least in the Democratic case, at the risk of disenfranchisement of quite a few of those no-party preference voters. Also coming up later this hour, Taylor Swift and allyship for the LGBTQ community. It's Pride Month, and Tay-Tay has a big single out right now that's getting a lot of attention, a lot of debate over whether it represents good allyship or maybe some self-centered allyship on her part. The pop song and the whole controversy we're going to cover later this hour. In the meantime, the Women's World Cup is moving into the quarterfinal stage in France this week, and teams are playing in front of big crowds and drawing healthy TV audiences. The women's game is growing, but comparatively, it still suffers from a lack of investment and attention that makes some of the gains during this captivating tournament kind of tenuous at best. And yes, the U.S. women's team, the favorites to win the World Cup this year, are still paid a fraction of what the U.S. men make. A team, it pains me to say, didn't even qualify for the tournament in Russia last year. I want to talk about this, the latest growth for the women's sport worldwide, and the U.S. women's fight for equal pay, with Jeri Longman, a sports reporter for the New York Times, covering a variety of international sports. And Jeri, you're actually in France right now for the World Cup. I am incredibly jealous. How are you doing? How has the experience been so far?
Well, you can never complain about a month in France.
It's a pretty big good gig you got there.
Yeah. No, it's it's an interesting tournament because we have never seen collectively since the Women's World Cup officially began in 1991. We've never seen this sort of collective standing up for equal treatment by various women's teams here. So we know that the United States team is here at suing the U.S. Soccer Federation for gender discrimination. The best player in the world, a woman named Ada Hegerberg from Norway, is not here. She refused to play because she's protesting against what she considers unfair treatment of the women in Norway. And they're in the quarterfinals. And with her, they may have had a chance to win. The Nigerian team staged a protest in the team hotel because they claimed the officials from their federation had not paid them prize money that they were owed. So you see this, but on the other hand, there are two other teams that I've written about here. So Jamaica, which is the first Caribbean team ever to qualify for the Women's World Cup, is basically here because of the daughter of Bob Marley, the reggae legend, Cedella Marley. A few years ago, the Jamaican Federation completely defunded the women's national team. So she raised a lot of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars of her own money, getting other sponsors to help.
Wow. So there's no national federation in Jamaica anymore for women. It's just one rich person.
There is. But they don't fund them to, as often happens in the Caribbean, where women are dismissed, women's soccer teams. They get a kind of a trickle of funding. And then there's Thailand, the team that the United States beat 13-0 in the opening round or the opening match. They are here. They receive very little funding. And so the general manager of their team, fortunately for the players, is one of the richest women in Thailand, a woman named Nuolphan Lamsam, who is the CEO of the largest insurance company in Thailand and the heiress to a banking fortune, who basically pays the salaries of the players. So they are semi-professional. So she hires them into her insurance company, helps pay their salaries so they don't have to worry about where the next paycheck is coming from. And they're so dependent on her that the players refer to her as mother. So you see, there's a wide variety of how women are treated around the world.
Yeah, it really
soccer
just
on display here.
Absolutely drives home that sense of These women are doing it oftentimes for the love still. They're not highly paid. Some at the very highest levels are able to make a living regularly in club matches and club teams that we're going to talk about in just 1 minute. But truly, this is a passion and will on display in this tournament for so many of these teams that are simply hanging on by the skin of their teeth in terms of being able to make a go at this as a professional, right? Or as a semi-pro, as the case may be.
Right. No, that's true. And on the other hand, recently these big European men's teams are starting to fund women's teams. So you're seeing a nation like Spain, which, you know, has a well-known soccer culture, which won the Men's World Cup in 2010, and where sexism and machismo were deeply rooted, just dismissed women for decades. It's now some women can lose their club contracts if they get pregnant. So but on the other hand, there's probably no country here that's sort of evolved in its thinking and its treatment of women than Spain, which now has, I was at a match in Madrid in March where they had 60,000 people at a match between Atletico Madrid and Barcelona. You've got a sponsor for the Women's League. The American company, Stanley Black & Decker, sponsors the Barcelona women's team, spending, you know, millions of dollars a year. There are now discussions to cover pregnancy costs and to have minimum salaries in the Spanish league. And the coach of the Barcelona men's team said in March on International Women's Day that he could foresee a time where the Barcelona men's team would be coached by a woman. So it's that country, maybe more than any other, has had this, you know, complete evolution and revolution and the thinking of what's possible for women's soccer.
Yeah, that's so amazing to me. It's also amazing that it took so long because of the dominance of these men's leagues in Spain, Italy, Germany, you know, the Premier League in the UK, all of them so popular, so much of a business opportunity. You'd think that before now they would have seen this massive marketing growth opportunity and made this happen. But as you say, there's a deeply rooted sense that, you know, there's a machismo element to soccer. There is an idea that it's a men's sport. I want to bring into the conversation Eileen Narcotto-Welp, soccer scholar and assistant professor in exercise and sports science at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. Eileen, can you talk about what you've witnessed in terms of the massive growth of women's soccer worldwide in the last few years? Because I think a lot of folks maybe remember Mia Hamm and Brandi Chastain at the Rose Bowl in 1999, but maybe they haven't been paying as close of attention in the meantime.
Yeah, and I mean, I'll bring you all the way back probably to the 1960s, 1970s. As you guys were talking before, and just listening to how soccer is very much entrenched in this idea of masculinity and machismo, many of these women's teams weren't even, not necessarily weren't just funded, but they actually were banned from playing the game of soccer. In England, for example, they were allowed to play in the early 1900s and actually were gaining quite a bit of fanfare and had people kind of following them around. But then around kind of World War I, and after the men came back from war, they kind of banned women from playing. So we see these bans going in a lot of the European countries and kind of the southern South America, Africa. Definitely in those areas. But then as you get through kind of the 1960s and 1970s, we start seeing kind of an explosion of women's soccer, and not necessarily by the federations or by FIFA, but kind of by private companies or women kind of taking it upon themselves and gaining some sponsorship through private companies. And so you had a few women's world championships in the early 1970s that actually profited and made some money. And FIFA FIFA actually ended up seeing this, realized that they could make a profit, but no one ever really jumped on it. And so what they started to do was institute quite a bit of new federation money for women, or at least they said that they were going to do this. But as we know, sometimes federations say these things, but they don't actually put it into action. So it wasn't kind of until there was a woman who went in front of the FIFA council and said, listen, there should be a Women's World Cup in 1986, that Sepp Blatter finally kind of held on to that and kind of created the first Women's World Cup in 1991. And then we've kind of seen what we have over the last, you know, gosh, 30 years or so.
Sure, sure. And then, you know, that massive attention from the final match against China in 1999 up through just amazing play by the U.S. over the years, multi-World Cup winners. Eileen Narcotta-Welp on the line with me talking about the growth of women's soccer. Also with us is Jeri Longman with the New York Times. Eileen, what do you think about the fight that the women are waging right now for equality? We saw Marta, the famous legendary Brazilian player, point to her shoe, you know, in the last game that the Brazilian side ended up losing, but Marta, you know, pointed to her shoe to a flag that indicated women's equality. And as Jeri was mentioning, there is a Norwegian star who has sat out. And of course, the U.S. women have sued the U.S. Soccer Federation for equal pay. And that has now moved into mediation. What do you think about these legal fights and these protests that have unfolded in women's soccer worldwide and, you know, their prospects for gaining ground?
You know, the protests amazingly aren't anything new. My dissertation was kind of on a critical cultural history of the U.S. team, and what I noticed as I was going from 1985 all the way to about 2007 is where I took it. Pretty much every 4 years, we would get into a cycle of kind of seeing the team fight for contracts and fight for equal pay, fight for equality, fight for pregnancy rights. They're fighting for, per diem increases. They're fighting for more pay for their play. They're fighting for health insurance. So each year you kind of see a little bit more that the United States is getting. But I think at this moment, we've seen such a steady increase in equity. I think right now we're at the precipice point where they're really starting to ask for equality.
Yeah. Eileen Narcotta-Welp from the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. Jeri Longman, also on the line, author of The Girls of Summer, the U.S. Women's Soccer Team and How It Changed the World. And he's in France, which I'm incredibly jealous about, at the FIFA Women's World Cup. Jeri, what do you make of the U.S.? Obviously the favorite to win, but we're seeing a lot of strong sides. How do you think Megan Rapinoe, Alex Morgan, and the whole crew are going to fare now going into a quarterfinal match against France, the home team?
Well, I'm always wrong. Let me preface everything I say by I'm always wrong in predicting the outcome of games. So it's unclear. Neither team has played great. Neither team was actually very good even in the second round. But both teams are incredibly fit, psychologically strong, determined. The United States has beaten France, I don't know, 18 out of 23 times, but France has won 3 of the last 8 matches, including a 3-1 exhibition in early this year, I think in January. So I don't know, it'll be interesting. But one of the key issues, at least soccer-wise, going on at this tournament is that, so of the 8 quarterfinalists, 7 are European teams and the other is the United States. So one of the questions that will be answered within the next, you know, 10 days or so is whether, so you often in Europe, you now, whereas in the United States, which pairs sports with education, you know, we have, for the American women, we have the high school and college system. In Europe now, you have 17-year-olds who are playing professionally in these, you know, in these leagues.
Just
in Europe.
Like so, with the men's sides.
Yes. And the question then will be asked, and I probably maybe premature to answer, but if the United States does not win this World Cup and the question will be asked whether the European professional system is now overtaking the American high school college system. And that's a question that could only be answered, you know, in the coming years. I mean, the United States won in 1999, the World Cup, and then Germany won in 2003 and 2007, yet that didn't signal a European takeover.
Sure,
you know, but the United States has come back and won.
You raise a good point because, you know, traditionally U.S. men's soccer, again, not even qualifying for the World Cup last year in Russia, they are kind of at a disadvantage worldwide because you don't have these extremely strong youth programs the way you do in Europe and South America, building up teams and building up players from, you know, the U7 and above age brackets. This is a system in the U.S. that largely leans on college soccer or has in the past. And do you, you know, think, and we're short on time here, so we'll have this conversation at an extended period later, but do you think that there is a chance that in the U.S. we could start seeing women maybe going straight into a professional league or going to play in Europe the way that we do on the men's side?
Yeah, so Lindsay Horan, the U.S. midfielder, did that, and it actually cost her. She played in France before the last World Cup and was not called onto the team precisely because she wasn't playing in the U.S. But I think we may see a number of American players go to Europe right after this World Cup.
Interesting. Jeri Longman with the New York Times and author of The Girls of Summer, the U.S. Women's Soccer Team and How It Changed the World. Also, we spoke with Eileen Narcotta-Welp this hour, soccer scholar and assistant professor in exercise and sports science at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. Thank you to both of my guests. I love talking soccer anytime I can. Libby Denkman in for Larry Mantle. We'll be all watching as the U.S. tries to go on in this tournament. Coming up next, we're going to talk about voter participation and the March 3rd presidential primary coming up in California. How will independent voters fare when, especially if they want to vote in the Democratic primary, they have to request a special ballot? That's all coming up after this short break on Air Talk. Stay with us.